This is episode 11 of Design Discipline, a conversation with Office of Possibilities, or OP in short. OP is a multidisciplinary design studio that creates objects and spaces based on well-informed strategic ideas with competences spanning architecture, art direction, exhibition design, industrial design, brand strategy, graphic design, and innovation strategy. I've personally been following OP since they were founded. In fact, as they were moving into their studio space in Gothenburg in Sweden a couple of years ago, I was living in the same building, right above their studio. Since then, they have built a formidable portfolio of projects involving brand identity, product design, architecture, exhibition design, and more, with clients such as Volvo, IKEA, H&M, Voice Scooters, and Electron Music Machines. I went back to my old neighborhood and sat down with Peter Hillinge and Kaspar Andrén, two of the studio's four co-founders, in order to get to know them better. We talked about their personal journeys that led to owning a design studio together, how they grew their company 100% during the COVID pandemic, in part due to their experience in functioning as a remote distributed team, how they communicate, sell, and execute truly interdisciplinary work, the great designers that they have learned from, the tensions between business and creativity, and many other topics that shed some light on the actual work of design. This was a truly wide-ranging conversation, so feel free to use the bookmarks that you will find in the description to jump around, and head over to designdiscipline.com/OP if you would like to have a look at a lightly edited transcript of the entire conversation. If you find any of this interesting, I'm sure you will also enjoy past and future episodes of Design Discipline, where we explore and explain the vast landscape of design by having conversations with scholars, leaders, and creatives, as well as explaining concepts that are useful for design professionals today. So go ahead and download and subscribe to our podcast, like and subscribe on our YouTube channel, follow us on Twitter and Instagram as @DesignDiscipline, and join the membership program on our website, designdiscipline.com, to access exclusive content as you enjoy our conversation with Peter Hillinge and Kaspar Andrén from OP, Office of Possibilities. I guess, first of all, like, what do you exactly do here? Like, how do you define the value that you create for your clients and for yourselves?
Well, first of all, we're part of the co-founders. We're two out of four. So there's also Robert and Axel. And yeah, me and Petter, we live in Gothenburg. So Axel lives in Stockholm and Robert down in Lund, in Skåne. We work with design in different aspects. We are like different disciplines. I'm from an engineering background, and Petter is...
I'm from a product design and industrial design background.
And Robert is an architect, and Axel is also an industrial designer. We work with design in both product design and architecture and graphic design. I think of design as a more of a strategic tool to our clients. It's very common to think of design as... yeah, we need it in the end to style the thing, to sell it, or something like that. And we would like to like more work with our clients with design as a strategic tool, as much as like the manufacturing or like the sales channels, or like it's part of the process of making something successful, even if it's like an exhibition or a product or a house or so.
And I think why we combine our fields of work is that we don't see design as only one thing, or like we don't see graphic design as only graphic design. All of a sudden, a sign becomes a physical object, and then it's a product, and then you know you walk into the sign, and then it's a building. I think we see it as one, basically. We don't see it as different genres.
Well, no, I think we've tried to define it on our web page. As most startups, it's like, okay, so what's our thing? And I think we would like to be, we don't want to be the thing to be static. We want it to evolve. But we are now at the point where we think that we work with objects and spaces for some, in some sense. So it's like, It's from a physical standpoint, yeah, at least. But
physical starting point, at least.
Yeah. Mm. But it's like, it could be a product, but it could also be a building or an environment. Or it's about creating the impact for the customer. And I think when we work with our customers or clients, we like to challenge them. Mm. They think they want to make something because they need a new product, and maybe they need a new product, but we want to challenge and understand why they need a new product, because, and in what context, and maybe how will you launch it, and how will you package it, and how will you...
And you need to really understand the whole picture, and I think we want to be part of that whole picture, somehow be part of the whole journey.
Yeah. And I mean, that all depends, of course, on the size of the client and so on. I mean, sometimes we can just be in a part of it, and in some cases we can do the whole thing. But we want to make sure that whatever we get engaged with, it's going to be as good as it can get. I mean, the name Office of Possibilities, like, it's part of that. It's like, that's why not take the challenge? Why not make an effort and try it out at least? And the worst thing that could happen is that you fail, and then you just try another one.
And then you learn, and then you do it again. So then that's, you know, how you come forward. In
that sounds really smart. I mean, it's kind of challenging to work, make some of these things work in practice. And I would like to ask you about those at some point, but I'm also curious about how you got to this point. So, like, what's your story? What's the story of the studio? What's the story of you two as individuals who got involved in this kind of career and then subsequently in this company?
I was more or less forced into this business by by a father who's an architect.
Oh, wow.
So, like, my siblings are all architects and landscape architects, and I became a product designer, started studying product design in high school, and then in Lund, and then started working in Copenhagen as a product designer for a company called Kilo, which is a part of Big now, Gerk Inge's group.
Yeah, they're super famous in the world of architecture, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. They had a small part of it doing product design. And but then at that point, I also started doing somewhat architecture, like doing bus stops and larger train stops, and that's like I was on a I was doing products that became so big structures that they were more or less architecture, which kind of stuck. And at that point I also worked with Robert, one of our other co-founders, and
because he worked at Big.
Exactly. So that's where we kind of, and we also studied together, so it all kind of, and we were always discussing this in the future, if we had an office, we would never work like this, or, you know, we would never do that. We would. So we had some somehow really interesting ideas and thoughts about how to run a business and what to focus on and what not to focus on and so on. But after Copenhagen, I moved back to Gothenburg. I got a few clients here that wanted to do design, and I opened up my own small kind of freelance business, and did that for 3 years before we somehow all, I think...
Yeah, because you and Axel, you met in Lund.
Absolutely, yeah.
At industrial design there. So you and Axel know each other since that time, and also talked about starting.
Absolutely, and we were all, that's what I meant, we were all four in somehow a stage in life, we were all kind of urging to do something new and to kind of lift the possibilities of what we could do together.
Nice.
And I think me and Axel have been discussing this since we studied, and Robert as well, And then we knew each other from here, actually, in Gothenburg.
We ran in this running club together, and our girlfriends knew each other since, like, childhood. So
that somehow, I mean, that's my, at least, end of the story, like, how how we met and I mean, you can do your story as well.
I guess I'm a bit of a joker in this this part, but so I'm from a background where my dad is an economist and my mother is an artist. So it's like structure and creativity, so to speak. And then I've always been fascinated and like sketching since I thought I could sketch and during my whole life and so on. So we actually went to the same high school, like with this more design angle to the high school called Polhems Gymnasiet here in Gothenburg. It's pretty famous in that kind of sense, I would say. And then I studied engineering because I always like to pull things apart, maybe not put them together, and are fascinated about cars and stuff like that. So I went to Linköping University, thought I was going to work with fighter jets because I thought they were awesome, and realized that that will not be the case. That seems really boring. You're just calculating all the time. So I studied mechanical engineering there. And then I got the job at a brand agency firm here in Gothenburg, where I worked with within a really cool team, working with product development as a part of brand development. So we looked into more like how could, if you're changing your brand, how could your products like take that step as well? What should you do more from maybe a innovative perspective, and had a really great boss that is a true visionary, and has been like, he had like several companies before, and it's like he can already see the idea before you even understand the problem. he sees the solution. So it was a really fun time, and we also started like a separate company there that I could be a part of. So we were scaling up the team, working more towards innovation and so on. But then from my background, I mean, my dad is an entrepreneur and my mom is an entrepreneur, so they are having their own businesses. So I was always thinking about like, I also want to start my own business. And then we started to talk. So that was like, then we met, and it all happened really fast. I think we started talking at a running session, actually, in maybe like October.
And I think a couple of weeks after, you were also part of the four kind of group.
Yeah, where we, exactly.
Where we decided that we're going to try this.
And then we started the company in the beginning of January. So it was like October, November, December, and then.
What is the state of play now? Like, how many people do you have? What, like, size-wise, where are you at today?
We're nine at the moment. We're specifically we're three architects. I would say three designers and two graphic designers, basically.
And that's really interesting because for us to be nine today, it's like last year we were five, and in the end we were six. So we were like, okay, feels about right. And last year was it was interesting. I mean, we learned a lot, of course. And as a new business, you're like, okay, so now there's a pandemic going on, and how to cope with that and everything.
You grew to almost like twice the size during COVID.
Exactly. So, I mean, we had like a really chill first half of the year, and then we started to pick up speed towards the end. And then this year has just exploded for us in that sense. I mean, we're still a small company, but for us being like four and now are nine within 3.5 years, it's
Yeah, I remember when you set up, actually. I was actually living in this building when you started this, and we didn't know each other back then, but I was, you know, getting out of my apartment and I was seeing like there's this thing in the corner going on. I think it was this was like a solarium or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
you were building this place and it became a design studio. And I was like, wow, I should meet these guys. And now we succeeded. But I'm wondering, during this period of time where you like started the company, now you're like sort of twice the size. Mm-hmm. Do you recall any like particular actions or investments that gave you like a disproportionate kind of return in terms of setting you up for success? And are there any actions or investments that went sort of very badly compared to the other things that you've done in your business?
This place. Mm. It's like we started actually in the living room, like because we didn't for the first weeks, and we had the contract with Volvo and IKEA and so on. So we didn't need a space that much. But then we had a couple of seats at this co-working space in Gothenburg, but figured out pretty early on that that was only temporary because you need your own space where you can like leave stuff and build models. And
it becomes a real company when you have your own space.
Yeah, when you put your name onto like a building, or as we have done, the windows, it's like, okay, so you exist. It's so...
it's a physical place where you can actually visit you guys.
Yeah, like, exactly. That's where you are. We can have a meeting at our place. It's like you get more confident, and I think the clients also trust you even more. It seems stupid, but...
It was a very scary investment for us.
Like, yeah.
Because you, the normal case is that you get it for 3 years. And I mean, at the moment, we had only existed like for a couple of months. So seeing 3 years in the future is scary in a way, but those 3 years went like that. And then,
I mean, I think we didn't know if we could pay like salary that month when we signed this deal for 3 years.
Wow.
And we were like, yeah, fuck it. I don't know if I can swear, but I mean, let's do that. And that's something you notice when you're like, you need to gas a bit, because whenever you put the gas pedal down, you get so much back. Yeah. Of course, you can't be like all YOLO and go nuts. You need, of course, a little bit of braking as well, but it's like when you staff up as well. Mm-hmm. And it's like, should we not? We're not sure about, could we really pay the salary for this person and everything? Mm. And then you hire one, and you're like, they are super creative, give more energy to the company, more things are happening. Mm. And suddenly you're like, why didn't we do that earlier?
Mm. Nice.
So that was, I would say that this place, I don't know if that's the same today.
Oh.
With the landscape of digital meetings and everything. Mm. But back then, absolutely for sure. And we're actually looking at a place in Stockholm. So I think we're...
Oh, nice. We want to have a similar studio in a way in Stockholm.
Yeah.
To have a physical place there.
So we still believe in that, at least, to have a physical space and the importance of it.
Yeah.
Even if it's not like... mainly for meeting customers and so on, but to have a place where you can, okay, I go to work and where I can be creative and meet the others. And
I think it's also important when you're working with like physical products, architectural prototypes, it really pays off to have your space, because it's like I do some product design work and I work from my living room most of the time. And it's really hard to sort of maintain the kind of the aesthetic of the living room at the same time as being creative with the products and things.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we have a small workshop here, but at least my goal is to have, just one full floor of only machines where we can build things.
That would be so cool.
That would be amazing.
I'd love to have that myself.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned that you have a many sort of people on your team living in different places. So we're in Gothenburg right now, but you mentioned someone is in Malmö, in Lund. So it seems that remote working has been a thing for you for many years. Like, how do you have any experiences that are interesting regarding that? Because now everyone is doing it, but it seems like you guys have been doing it for a little bit longer.
Yeah, I mean, that was I would say we knew it from the beginning because Axel lives in Stockholm and Robert then he lived in Malmö. Yeah, we just had to deal with it, but we were fortunate to have like a small apartment where they could stay when they were here, and they were
here quite a lot in the beginning.
2-3 days a week at least. So they were sacrificing a lot in that sense, but we also had like most of the clients here and so on. So it felt naturally.
Do you have any like habits, rituals, processes to keep you all in sync? Like do you have weekly meetings or how does it work for you?
Daily meetings every morning.
Yeah.
Basically at least us four, but also the full team. So every morning we have at least 15 to 30 minutes of just talking to the full group. Mm. And that's like more or less the starting point of every day. And it has been really, really, really good for us because in one way, when COVID kind of came in, we didn't really know how to handle it.
Mm.
Because then at that time before that, we would always meet a couple of times a week and then you would have all of those time to discuss projects and how things were going and so on. And I think this morning meeting was very, very good for us.
Yeah. And it's also been quite hard to find like ways to collaborate creatively online.
Yeah.
That's been a challenge. I mean, having meetings with clients and like just do checkups and discuss things, totally fine. Of course, Teams and all the programs working fine for that. But to work like creatively solving a problem, I think we have found some tools to do that, but that's still more to come, we feel, in that space. And we feel a lot of energy to still meet and like be physical to meet and interact together and solve a problem. I mean, seeing each other for a day or two in Lund or here or in Stockholm will easily solve like a week's worth of absolutely. Work.
I think we've solved by digital tools, we've solved a way where we can kind of find inspiration, find references, the starting point of a project, but it's still the fact of creating the concepts, like sitting next to each other, sketching. I'm looking at something you sketched, which looks like something, and I in my mind it looks like something else, and then I sketch on something, and you know that kind of interaction is really hard to do.
And you overhear someone talking about the problem, or you can get input. Or
you're doing this remotely, are there any like tools or software or ways of doing things that you really sort of like your favorites among these? Do you have any specific things that are like your go-tos?
I think Slack in a way revolutionized our way of communicating in terms that we had so many different projects running at the same time.
Mm. And Miro.
And Miro was also a huge help on kind of having a good overview of what's happening.
Mm.
And instead of looking through a lot of PDFs, you would just get a grasp idea of what's happening and much, much freer tool.
But I mean, if your audience, if they have any tips, we would like to have them.
I don't think we're done. We're not set to those tools. It's just like those tools are things.
They are solving a bit of the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I hope they might leave some comments on the YouTube page or maybe on Twitter. We'll get some tips from them.
I think. But I mean, from the daily work, it's like the. Yeah. It's Rhino and SolidWorks and the Adobe Suite, as for many studios, I would say. But also, like we love our 3D printer and
prototypes in general.
Yeah, and that's not typical at all as well. But it's really important to make like physical prototypes. It's so easy that you just stay within the screen. Whenever you get out from the screen, you learn a lot more.
Like just stupid prototypes that. Doesn't, you know, that just try the...
Cardboard.
Exactly. Cardboard or paper or whatever you can find to...
Yeah. Or just visit something to get new impressions. And I mean, that's not news to anyone, but it's always, it strikes you every time when you're like...
I saw that on your Instagram, actually, recently. Mm. You went to this, like, was it marble, stone, some kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, stone, what it's called?
Quarry.
Stone quarry. Yeah.
Do you do that often?
We don't do it that often, but we've done it before. We've done, like, a full tour of Småland to look at metal, like aluminium casting and aluminium stamping and so on. And this time we took us for like a summer kind of end trip with all the big group. And we went to a stone artist called Paul Svensson to see his work and how he works with stone as a material. And then we went to a quarry to look at how do you actually get stone out from the mountain.
I think the learning is that we should do it more often.
Yeah.
I mean, we want to do it. It's mainly a question about time to get like, okay, now everyone should go here. So
because that's, we also realized that that is like real research. Yeah. Instead of looking at, you know, internet, finding someone else who has found something, it's like, two steps in between. So in this case, it's like direct.
Yeah,
and you touch and feel much more. And
were you doing these as part of a particular project, or was it just
general studio fun time?
Exactly. But then in projects as well, we try to like, if we develop a product, design a product for a specific target group, we try to interview them or understand how they use existing products today, or if we are going to do something with a building, we definitely want to go there and take a look.
Absolutely.
I mean, and that's really important, because it's so easy that you I can just look at the Google Maps or get the drawings or do some research or get the brief, but
I mean, in a way, like suppliers, you could say, are a huge part of design. So, like, it's easy to come up with the idea, but to make it real, you need somehow, you know, all the tools to make that real or that idea as good as possible.
Yeah.
And then suppliers and, you know, yeah.
I guess that's not unique in any sense, but it's always important, and it's you have to have this reminder for yourself, like, okay, let's get real. Let's go out in the real life to understand the problem. And also, like, we still want to make more physical models and stuff like that all the time, because it's so easy, because it's much faster to work in the digital. But the learnings are greater with a simple model.
Cool.
And this is, I think, a nice segue into how you do things, because we've spoken about what you do, and I'm super curious about how you actually do it. So maybe we can start at maybe zooming out and sort of the, like, I guess, administrative level. Like, according to your website, for example, you have four co-founders, and you all have like different job titles on the website. One of you is a CEO. You have industrial designer, design director, creative director, and these things can mean different things in different contexts. So, in the context of a design studio like yours, what is the meaning of these job titles? Why do you call yourselves these things?
And I would say it's more or less to only communicate to clients maybe sometimes. And for it, like, the communication is more or less what is the scope depending on what clients want. And the difference maybe between a creative director and a design director is that the creative director maybe looks at the bigger picture, and the design director maybe looks at the small edge eventually to have full control of that.
It's more of a effort to make a structure to be able to grow even more, I would say, and to get a clear, especially when the team is growing as well.
Yeah.
It's like, it's both for the client to easier navigate, okay, who should I call or get in contact with for this question, but also when your team is growing. I mean, if you have like four chickens or roosters that are just wandering around and like who should I ask for this? It's like, it's better to have like, okay, so that's the design director. I will ask him. Or like, not that we want to make this pyramid structure, but in some sense have like a point towards something, I would say. And yeah, and that's what we are trying now. Maybe that's totally wrong in the future. Yeah. We will see, I would say. But that's, we felt the need for it. So that's why we changed from not having titles to. So, but from like a project perspective, it's, as you say, like you are looking and more responsible for the details, and Robert is more like the holistic visionary approach, and I'm more, I don't use the CEO role in any sense, so I'm more from a strategic point to understand the problem and that we have the correct brief. And
And I think Axel's role now is design management or design manager. And I mean, he has the bigger role of controlling a creative process as well, which is a huge task.
I mean, many people in our audience are like design students or design educators and, you know, I guess younger design-related professionals who are still sort of finding their way. So that's the reason why I become curious and ask these questions, for the benefit of those people who are still trying to understand these terminologies and these roles that happen in these kinds of places. And so if you don't mind, for that reason, I'd like to ask about some like operational details as well. So you have mentioned that the work that you do covers a lot of disciplines. There's architecture, there's product design, there's branding, and depending on the strategic needs of the client and the project, you choose one of those. As far as I know, you start with the strategy. You don't start with the tactical sort of implementation of it, which theoretically sounds really cool. But in practice, I also expect that there is a lot of differences between between how you execute these disciplines. Like, for example, you know, just a simple example is that for a graphic design project, I would expect the cost to be on the order of thousands of dollars. For product design, the cost of a project would be tens of thousands of dollars, and for architecture, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. So how do you scope and plan these projects? Can you describe like a real encounter with a client where you sit down and you decide on the scope and the size of this project and which of these disciplines to execute on?
I think it's always client-based. I mean, because making the, not that we have done, but make the graphics for Lufthansa would, I would say, not cost thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
It would be in the hundreds of thousands or even more. And
it always depends on the impact that you do for the company. And so we try to understand what will this impact do for the client.
Because we, as we said earlier, we want to work with design as a like a strategic important tool, like to make it impactful, and then in that sense we make value, not hours, as many charge their clients. So it's, it more depends on the size of the client and the impact you can make and the responsibilities or the freedom you get. So maybe when we work with a, as we talked about earlier about the coffee, I mean, it's a one-man show today, so then we get
the coffee company, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So, I mean, then we get maybe more freedom. But so that what we see as a value for ourselves and maybe what we can create for him. But he doesn't necessarily have the money in that sense. But then you work with a bigger client. Then you have more limitations. But the impact you will create within these limitations, because it's a big company, will be even greater. So then you can maybe charge more for that. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
It does, especially since I have done some projects with various sizes of companies. I also know that, you know, the bigger the company that you deal with, the bigger the administrative work that you have to do and the longer time it takes. So the cost, the hours that you have to put in actually increase based on the size of the client that you're dealing with also, just purely because of the size basically of the project.
Exactly, and that's also part of the challenge, because working a lot of our clients they are maybe not that familiar in buying creativity.
Oh yeah.
So that's a part of the challenge, to talk the same language. Yeah. Because maybe they are from a budget perspective or a project lead perspective, where they have their timelines and their gates, and they need to fit in this creative space and process to make the impact for the project. So that it's important to educate each other, I would say, be able to fulfill whatever they need, but they need to understand our way of working as well. So
there's so much,
because there are two languages, I would say, in that
and
sense.
There's a lot more communication only, not only design. You could say it's the bigger the client, the more you have to talk to, you know, different parts of that company, and somehow, in a way, you know, convince more people. The smaller the company, the straighter the process.
Yeah. And this is really interesting. I was actually talking to a young designer a couple of weeks ago, and he used to be one of our students. Now he's graduated and he's looking for different jobs and different alternatives. And I told him that if you want to really move forward and sort of take control of your career, you have to study and learn the language of business. You have to learn maybe about accounting, maybe about marketing, you know, how companies are divided and how they work, and sort of the language and concept of business. Because even if you just want to do design, if you sit down with a client and you look at this person, you look at this company, and you're able to see what's behind this one person, the internal structure, the internal goals, and how value and how aims and purpose flows inside of this company, then you will be able to make progress with that client and subsequently with your work in general. I don't know if this is actually good advice from your perspective, who has more experience with this.
That approaches our next challenge that I would say that we talk a lot about, and that's the artistic freedom.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're a creative, so you want to be an artist in some sense. And adapting too much towards budgets and time plans and structures and business language is not necessarily creative. And that's a frustration. And we are like on the search of how could we combine that in the best way possible, so we can feel that we have the creative freedom and
creative time
to
react and do it again and learn and so
but
on.
Still like
deliver
for our clients, because that would be the greatest of impacts if we don't like kill the creativity with like all the limits, but we don't like kill the possibilities of realizing the project because of the creative freedom that we want. And that's like a balance that we are still, of course, searching for, and I guess we'll search for many years to come. But we think it's very important, and we talk about it a lot, because sometimes we could get really frustrated because we feel there are a lot of limits. The constellation that we had from the beginning of different disciplines, we bring in different relations and clients and projects into the company. So, I mean, I haven't worked with architecture before, but now I do, which is really cool. I don't call myself an architect, but I could be a part of the process and bring some insights or questions or knowledge to the table, which is really interesting. Cool. And it's like, so that's what we like. And that's also mixes, as we talked about, like small and big companies. So then you get this mix, which is really nice, I would say, for the both the creativity. We can also find like synergies between maybe big and small companies and projects, but also like the rhythm. Because when you work with the bigger clients, they move forward as fast as they can, hopefully, but it's never as fast as we can move forward. And then you work with the really small clients, and then we are the bigger one, maybe not moving forward as fast as they want. And so you get this like
pace. And also the, I mean, the limit somehow from the client is quite important. I mean, at some point you also need a boundary for the creativity.
Oh yeah.
So you want somehow you have to have a wall to
bounce
your and I think having those kind of clear lines from the beginning always makes a good project. It's like having a really good brief is what sets the possibility for the project.
Okay.
Because if it's totally free, then you can go on for forever.
With some clients, we have like a super clear brief.
Mm.
But in some cases, we don't.
Mm.
And then it's up to us, we think, to understand the problem better. So to ask a lot of questions to the client, to maybe do some research and and visit customers that will use this product or experience or whatever, to understand and create a better brief for ourselves. So we know what is the goal of this project. And in that case, when we do it ourselves, it's really fun because maybe we can find an angle that we would like to do this.
Hmm.
You mentioned the brief, and in the world of design, we all know what a brief looks like, and we also know what the end products look
like.
Do you? Well, everyone does have their own version of it. Yeah, me too. I mean, everyone has something that they imagine when they talk about the brief. Yeah. It's not like they have nothing. It is different, though.
Feels like that way sometimes.
Do you have a format for your like brief, or does it change from client to client?
It changes, I would say. I mean, as I said before, it's like it all depends on the client.
Yeah.
Some are like super specific. We have this product. We want to make it this. It need to fulfill this. Blah, blah, blah.
It's going
to
be new in these kind of senses, but these needs to be kept the same way as before and so on. So.
Or we want to make an exhibition about this. Mm. It's going to be between these two dates. We have this budget and so on and so on.
Mm.
But there can also be like, we want to explore this.
Mm.
We want to target a new group of customers, or we want to make a future exhibition of what will come in the future, and we don't know yet, and we want you to find out, and so that's also a mixture. But
interesting.
When they're good, I think like when they're good, they're well thought out, both from the customer and we've been able to debrief them, so that we've been able to kind of question the brief a couple of times. That's usually when they become good. Usually the really loose ones where there's nothing really to grasp onto, those are
really hard.
So
you need a couple of iterations on the brief to make it into something that's like actionable, I guess.
And I would just like to add, I mean, it's like you don't want to get too standardized either, I would say. No, we don't want to, because if we have this format and we always work on this and follow the process and so on, then you just become a machine.
Oh yeah.
And how creative is that? So you want something that can adapt and you listen and you ask questions, you understand, and you challenge questions or the brief and so on. So you try to find that creative height that you want. Because if you're like, first we do these steps and da da da, and that's, I would say, maybe super smart from a business perspective, just to have like this standardized product. Like, oh, you want a new product. It will take this long and cost this amount of money. And you're like, okay, perfect, dunk. And then another one, we say the same thing and da da da. But how fun is that for us? I mean, it's like, then we just become this big machinery.
This word creative is very rich in different meanings, you know.
And important, I would say. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, everyone has different like meanings, feelings, and sort of associations about it. Can you concretely give examples of maybe one project where it was like, from a perspective of being creative, it was very successful and very satisfying, and compare that to a project where, from the perspective of being creative, it wasn't didn't really live up to what you want to have in your life?
I think we've done very successful kind of exhibitions in the sense that they've been both for the for us, they've had the right height of creative kind of level where we feel like we've, you know, achieved a greater kind of aesthetic feel and experience, but also where, like, you've heard that people have had a really good time visiting that spot, visiting that experience.
And I would also say the restaurant in Stockholm, Deglabbet,
really
go and eat there. When we came up with ideas, they just executed them. So because they were opening a pizzeria in Stockholm, in a part of Stockholm called Vasastan, which is a really saturated market for a pizza place.
Yeah.
And we created this, like, okay, so we looked at the problem and, like, okay, how could we create an impact? I mean, it's lovely that they want to open another pizza place, but how will they actually not be, like, bankrupt in a day? Because there are too many. Then we created this brand that was, like, bright and yellow, and, like, all the pizza carts were yellow, so you could spot them like a mile away. And they are really sharp guys running this place. So there was, of course, like, location and their impact on social media and all the aspects. But that case became, like, really, we gave them input on how we would like to do this creatively. And they just, yeah, we trust you. And that became a super success. I think they sold like 300% more pizzas within the first 2 weeks than they had expected, or something like that.
Nice.
So that's a really nice one. And then, because that's, like, more of a, from a business perspective, but they gave us the total freedom and, like, okay, really cool, we trust you. And with exhibitions, it's really fun because you have this, they want the creative height because it's an exhibition, so it should be more art history. And and a really bad case.
I mean, there's also the levels of bad, but sometimes there's, we've done projects like
we don't do bad cases.
No, no, that's the goal. But and sometimes they're not bad in the sense that, you know, ideas are specifically good or bad, but if the company are not able to execute the ideas, it doesn't help that it's a good idea.
Yeah.
So sometimes our level of ideas have to match the level of competence in the company. Otherwise, it takes too long time to launch things. Or it's, in production wise, it's going to cost too much, which will make the product too expensive in the end, or the service too expensive. So I think those levels you learn all life. Like, you won't ever be fully learned on it, but you can always learn that, oh, this time it was actually a little bit too complex, or, you know, pushing the limits of what that company could achieve. And I mean, I have several experiences like that where I felt like either I should push more or push less.
Yeah, and maybe done some more research in that sense, maybe find out a bit more about the budget and more question about the organization and how will you manage decisions and so on. Because you, we get so fired up within a project. So we're like, okay, and this is a great idea. And we just push. And maybe we had the brief from the beginning to push. But we didn't know about the limits within how we could push. And then we are fired up and we present this idea. And they're like, yeah, this is great. So we get even more energy and we continue to work on that. And then they're like, but we... And the next time we meet, we won't have the budget for this. And we're like, okay. So then it's like back to the drawing board or scaling down. And then
That's actually a very frequent complaint that I hear from people who work with designers. I have an acquaintance who makes different gadgets out of plastic, for example, and he has commissions a lot of things to industrial designers, different objects, different shapes, and he frequently complains that they deliver these designs which he can't manufacture on his machines, that they require like this complicated machine or this complicated die or mold that will cost him another $100,000 or whatever. Yeah. So it pays off, I guess, to do research into the capabilities of your client in terms of what they can manufacture, what they can execute. Speaking of like, I guess, bad experiences, we kind of avoid speaking about those a lot of the times, but I find it extremely productive. And from both a career standpoint and from a personal, you know, psychological happiness standpoint, I find it very productive to know what you're not going to do and to be clear about it and like to say no, to put it in a general term. So I'm wondering if you had any experiences where you've said no to particular clients and particular projects.
It's like a relationship. When you realize that this relationship will never work, it will never become a good project in this relationship or whatever we, you know, find with the client, then you have to say stop, because then it becomes draining with energy and draining your creativity, and somehow what we're looking for is when we can somehow excel and become even better at what we do, and I think the clients are really important in that. I mean,
and that's also part of like growing and aging and maturing as a company, because in the beginning you don't say no of several reasons, almost. I mean, of course you can, but I would say it's like the last year or so we've been saying no, because now we know more of what we want to do, and we have learned more about maybe not saying yes to all the projects, because we try to get more information before we make a decision. But it's also that energy and that, like, okay, yeah, we got a new assignment, a new client. Yes, let's do this. It's going to be amazing. So
it's interesting that you mentioned like your reputation and putting your signature on things. I was reading David Ogilvy recently, like a legendary advertising writer, and he was saying in his book that advertising writers should sign their adverts, like there should be the name of the agency on the corner of the magazine ad, and when you do that, it increases the quality and the sales and the results by very significant degrees.
But I remembered when I was younger, when you're at the bus stop, you always have these like ads. Ads, and they were always the name of the agency. So you could read like, oh, Forsman Bodenfors.
Apparently that increases the quality of the ads too.
Yeah,
but I think so. I think that would be a good lesson for clients to, I mean, that has been a typical traditional way of doing it, that you always put the name of the designer onto the product. Or whatever it is, or architecture in old fashioned, where you writ it on the building, because then you know that people really will take care of how it's gonna look and become and feel and the experience. So
You know, it's a fancy building when it has like a plate at the entrance with the name of the architect. Yeah. That's how you know you're in the good building.
And just having that on the, you know, lower side of a stool or something, that you can find out who did it.
Yeah,
like who put the stamp on it, the mark on it. I think
it's like you're really showing that you're proud of your work and you stand behind it. And like, I can meet you in the street and see you in the eyes, and I'm like, we've done this building and we're proud of it. But nowadays it feels like just another building or just another product. And that's another part for us that we would like to, I mean, we're proud of what we're doing, even if it's like not always. The end result is not always the way we wanted, of a lot of different reasons. But so we want to take pride and not only communicating within social media and so on. So we went to Helsingborg the other week for a project with IKEA, and then we walked down the street and saw this building where it was like this sign in stone, automobiles and carriers. So it's been there since. Horse and the carrier and automobiles. I mean, that's then you know that like, okay, we're gonna be here for a while when you put your sign into stone. And like, and now it was like some hairdressing salon or something, but the sign was still there, and that would be really cool, like to have that. I mean, I would see, I would like to see more pride in a longer term than just some likes on social media. And also like that things are genuine. We talked about that a lot. If you make something in plastic, make it look like plastic and use the nice ways you can form plastic. No, don't make it look like wood, but it is plastic. And use like wood when it's wood and stone when it's stone, and all those like genuine materials and
I think that that's also the, you know, when the clients have the same philosophy in that sense as we do, that's when it's a good client. And and when we feel that it's not, they're like not triggering any of our kind of what we like, and then that's when we should stop.
Okay, speaking of signs and philosophy and materials, I think this is a perfect segue into another thing that I wanted to ask you, which is basically like, and I have two ways of asking this. One is more abstract, and I guess I'll start with that one. So what even is your design philosophy? So for example, if you could scale your studio to infinity, you could have infinite people working for you, all the projects in the world, so you can design the whole world, all of the architecture, all of the products, all of the graphics in the world, it's OP. What would the world look like? Like, what are some words that would describe our world designed by OP?
There will be big statues of us all over the globe. And
we had the saying the other day that we are fighting ugliness with good ideas.
Yeah.
And I mean, and what we mean with good ideas is like, as we talked about before, that, you know, optimizing materials for what they're good at and finding good ideas instead of styling things after.
Yeah.
So trying to make things real, so they feel real, and they, they, what you experience of the product or space is real. And really having, you know, creating more, you know, fun spaces to live in, to socialize in, more products that are even more fun, and you know,
it's about seeing what it is for what it is, I would say. I mean, if it's temporary or a single use or whatever, make it in that sense then. And don't like, because nowadays it seems like a lot of effort is going in to something, to create something, but you know that within a year you will launch the next product. So you don't give it that love or whatever you need.
Minimizing kind of an artificial world, but also at the same time maximizing a colorful world, so that, you know, it's a colorful experience in that sense.
We don't have any principles. It would be, if we should take over the world, we need that, but we're working on it.
Yeah, and
I
mean,
I think it was Steve Jobs who said that the dots connect looking backwards. So to connect the dots, you need the dots in the first place. Before you have the dots, you can't know how your philosophy or how your sort of idea is going to turn out before you actually do things. But it's very easy to look back and then extract a philosophy from what you've already been doing, from a collection of work that you've done already. But in practical terms, so you've been saying, I don't know, real, fun, colorful. So in practical terms, let's say that I'm a younger designer, maybe I'm a student, and I want to learn by copying the master. So I want to copy the work of OP to learn how things are done. What are some like aesthetic elements, like colors, materials, typefaces, anything that we find in like maybe every OP project, or things that you like to use and some things that you like to avoid maybe? What would be those things?
I mean, those things are really maximizing an impression and maximizing the total kind of experience of what we do. And I think doing that, it's like always cleaning out all the fuss so that the message becomes as clear as possible. Mm. And with fuss, we mean like styling, getting rid of as much as possible, but still keeping a stance of, how do you say, it still needs to be a strong aesthetic feel. Mm. And I think those are the hardest things to combine. Mm. But in a way, we are we try to always minimize somehow weird kind of aesthetical things and try to keep it simple. Mm. Keep it to, you know, we like geometric shapes. We like strong colors in that sense. But we also like, you know, it all depends on what it should do in the end.
Maybe in a couple of years or so, you will find some kind of, you can look back and see some kind of red thread through the whole thing. But I think it's also about being creative. You need to explore. And I mean, it could be that you have like really strict limits and you be creative within that field.
Yeah.
But I think we want more to combine different knowledges and educations and ways of thinking and be more creative in that sense. And then we cannot be that strict with a typeface, three colors, and on. And we want to explore as well, I would say. And
I can see that here, actually. When I look around in your studio and there are various objects that you have designed or different prototypes, and I can see that there's no, like, you know, patterns, lines, shapes, or anything. There's none of that. It's just the material, and it's very honest. It's like steel, wood, whatever it is, plastic. But there's still some playfulness. There's interesting, curious elements in all of them. Yeah. I mean, like, this thing makes me wonder, for example, what is this thing that we have in the middle of the...
It's genuine.
I think it's made for ventilation, but it's stainless steel. But, I mean, what we aim to do is... in a short sentence, I would say it's like when you have a good idea, you have to design less.
Oh yeah.
If you have a bad idea, you have to design more, and it becomes harder to design. Mm. So the better, the cleaner, the simpler, the more impactful the idea is, the simpler it is to design. And that's what we're always depending on. If it's a graphical project or a product design or architecture, we always want to have good ideas, so that instead of talking about the design, you talk about the good functions and ideas that the design has done.
Mm.
If you have a good idea, you need to design less. I'm going to tweet that, man. That's really smart. Are there any people or other companies or, I don't know, artistic movements or whatever that you look up to, like any influences that you... That have really influenced, I guess,
your work. Of course.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah. We look both into what's happening around us, but also really what has, you know, some of our biggest maybe influence are some of those kind of designers from the past who were able to do both the kind of bigger picture, being able to do a big scope, both architecture, product, graphic. But they were also really good at executing those big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Sweden, we had Sigurd Levrens and Gunnar Asplund, which were, I mean, they were pioneers in architecture and design. Mm-hmm. And they really, you know, set the pace for all Scandinavian design.
I think we're also like really interested in how did they, I mean, of course, aesthetically, they're really pleasing their designs and everything. But also like, how did they manage to go through with those kind of things? And like,
absolutely,
it's like we also look up to other agencies within maybe different fields. Like, but how did they manage to grow their business and be in that sense? As, I mean, it could be also not only from aesthetic point of view. It's like they have navigated through the landscape, and
absolutely.
And
would you care to give some examples of who those are?
Yeah, but I mean Gunnar Asplund, Sigurd Levrens. I mean, but also like we visited Luciana many times. Also, like just from a building perspective, it's like old but really nicely done and everything. And we talk about like. Forsman, Bodenfors, of course, because here in Gothenburg, they're also
huge,
from.
Yeah,
and they have navigated through that jungle of agencies in a really good way and become like legends.
Yeah.
And we're like, we don't know yet, but we would like to have a chat. But how did they manage that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, that's also interesting.
But I think those, I mean, in we had, you know, in Sweden or like in Finland, you had Alvar Aalto, who were able to, and his company, Aina Aalto, they were able to do all of it.
Yeah.
I think those are the, you know, the most, the ones that I can look up to most.
Yeah.
Mm. In US, you had Ray and Charles Eames, who were able to do, you know, chairs, architecture, graphics, and they could really execute on it. Because there's a lot of companies who try, but they don't have all the crafts and learnings to do it, I think. Seeing design as one, basically.
Mm.
I mean, because we believe it is one. They all interact.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the premises of this project, of design discipline as well. They all interact and they all have something to learn from each other. But speaking of influences, I really love books, and I wonder if there's a book or really any resource, you know, an article, a YouTube channel, a website, whatever, that you recommend very frequently to people that you work with to check out.
A recent book I read was Sprint by
Jake Knapp.
Yeah, Jake Knapp. Yeah, that was a bit. Yeah, I think it was interesting. I mean, it really pushed the boundaries of how fast you can make a sprint, I think, with the qualities.
Mm.
That was interesting. And been listening a bit to a podcast and YouTube channel called Future.
Oh, yeah, The Future.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it's really American, and maybe feels a bit awkward as a Swedish person to look at it. But from a business perspective and the educational perspective of starting your own business, it's really interesting.
I think there should be more of those. There's quite a. I mean, the
I'm
network.
Really missing the transparency within the business, like knowing the backgrounds and. I mean. Not only hear about the success and everything, it's like, sometimes it's like shit and we learned this and then we could pivot or like make changes that may, gave us this opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think that's, there's a window for that, I would say, within the podcast or like YouTube market.
Do you have a favorite failure in your career that set you up for success in that
and
way?
And it could be like you start a project with a client and you have like this budget and this time frame, and then you work your ass off like three times as much, and then you're like, ah, maybe that wasn't the best of choices. And it could be like, as we talked about, that you get fired up and you think you will like revolutionize the world with this coffee mug, and then you don't have the opportunities later on in the project to succeed that way.
Did a tent for a car once. That was a huge failure.
A tent for a car?
So like it's an add-on tent for a car.
Oh, wow. To like sleep in?
To like change. I mean, the client, the car company, wanted us to do that, but it somehow was an impossible project. It didn't work. But
I think
the learning somehow is that because your stomach before starting the project was like, this will never work, and then after doing the project, it didn't work.
Yeah.
Sometimes you should kind of listen to your stomach from the beginning. And in a sense, you don't want one chance. I mean, that's why you want to fail forward. You want to have a client who wants to do something, but then they don't want to stop with that only thing. Then you want to do it again. And then you know, improve it even more. And then you want to do a new one and improve. So, and like having clients who don't only see at making, how do you say, one hit wonders. We want to make, you know, constant hits all the time.
Yeah, because we always walk into this relation for a long term. And that could sometimes be a failure when we break up more earlier than we thought. I mean, and then you're like, okay.
To me, that's kind of like the essence of design. It's like iteration and trying things and failing and doing things more than once, doing it 3, 4, 5 times, each time increasing in terms of the investment and the effort and the like the definition of the thing, and then eventually arriving somewhere, not just, you know, okay, I made this, this is it. That's not, it's not design if you do that. Maybe it's engineering, maybe it's something else, might even be an artistic piece or whatever. But to me, the meaning of design is iteration. So I'm wondering if there's a thing about design that is obvious to you, but you observe is not obvious to a lot of other people.
The failures you can really see when someone has not done all the ideas. They've just like taking a quick one, you know, like a coffee cup where you can't fit your finger into the... Then you know that people, you know, things that are stupid and not smart usually become ugly in a way.
I see.
And I think those sense, I mean, that's where I think we can see it quite quickly.
Or if we don't, that was my point, that we maybe put a bit more extra time into it to understand. Yeah. So, as you say, like, if you have a good idea, it's not hard to design.
No. So it's like a survival of the fittest idea.
Oh yeah, yeah. Evolution.
Evolution somehow makes things look good.
Oh yeah.
You know, like like a lot of things in nature look good and has a pure, you know, idea and meaning why they look like they do.
Interesting. So evolution, studying, copying things and sort of understanding the intuition of why things look good.
Never copy, but learn. Maybe.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess as an exercise, as a learning experience, copying is very, very valuable. Like,
Because we don't want to make copies.
Yeah, not when you make it, not when you like deliver to the client. But you know, I was I had to make some graphic designs for this project for like social media. YouTube thumbnails, whatever, and I'm not really educated in graphic design, actually. So I had to sit down and study, and the absolute most valuable learning experience that I had was when I took the famous book by Josef Müller-Brockmann, Grid Systems in Graphic Design. I put it in front of my keyboard. I turned to the page where he has like these examples of his work, and I started copying all of them. I did like 20 of them in Figma, exactly replicating the layout. And I'm like, ah, okay.
So
that has to be proportional to that. And your line height has to be proportional to your margin, because then it fits this way and it aligns and so on. But I'm wondering, so we also talked about like contextual awareness and awareness of use, like if your finger fits in the coffee cup and things like that. So when we teach design, we talk a lot about like research methods and things. So we have things like design sprints, as you mentioned, user-centered design, design thinking. There's different names of these like recipes that you can follow. What do you think about these? And when you do your research, or what you call research, what does that involve? What is the process? What are some things that you do?
I mean, it depends on the project and the client and so on, and the scope and the time frame. I mean, if we get a clear picture in the beginning and it's a tight time frame, or we maybe get ideas early in the discussions and so on, we start maybe working on that directly.
Like if it's somehow it's already done on some level.
Exactly. It could be. And then maybe we get stuck, and then we do some research and so on. But in some cases, we need to do a lot of research, like interviewing people. And it's always good to meet someone that will be...
Don't be afraid of just...
Using or living or experiencing the thing you're designing. Yeah. So it's like... I mean, we've been up with truck drivers like 5 in the morning, just interviewing them when they're driving about some products. And we've been interviewing organizations for how their future offices will look like. So it's like
meeting
people
who actually experience this every day.
Yeah.
And we've realized that if we have a like certain amount of those meetings, we've gotten a lot of knowledge in a short time. So it's just for us to be able to do better work, basically.
And you don't need that many meetings. No. I mean, it's like maximum 10,
yeah.
I would say. Sure. It's like...
Even in like...
After like five, you have almost like 80% of the findings, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, even in academic research, you know, the expectation is that you have to be like super thorough, you know, you have to cover everything, like...
Very quantitative.
Yeah, if you're doing like interviews, it's usually very deep, you know, you're talking to someone for 2-3 hours, then you do 10 of them, you know, you don't do 20 or 30, that's sort of...
Sometimes
and observing. And observing,
Only observing, like having time to observe how... a person uses a space or an object without them knowing that you are looking at them. Yeah. It's quite fun as well.
I mean, with the truck drivers, for instance, they had this like crane operating trucks, so they could hoist like windows up to buildings or whatever. Mm. And I mean, we spent some time with them when they were driving, interviewing them, and then we were just went to them to this site where they did their work, just walking around, looking how they were doing things. Wow. And then maybe ask some more questions about, okay, so you talked about safety. That's really important. But you should never walk under your load that you were hoisting. Mm. But you just did that. And they're like, oh, okay, wow, did I do that? why is that? Oh, that's because I had to, la, la, la. Uh-huh. So then you maybe pick up these small details and maybe you get insights to, okay, so if we could get the guy to not die when he's working, it's like a super benefit for this product.
I've taken a lot of your time already. I have a few more questions, very few, maybe three, before we call it a day. And as I said, many people in our audience are design students and design educators. So I'm wondering, like for a student, for example, who's in school today and they have 1 year, maybe 2 years left in their education where they can just study things, experiment, do things. What would be some really valuable skills or topics that they could invest in if in the near future they would like to either work at a place like this or start a place like this or be in this business of design?
As you mentioned in the question, to explore and to like try out new things, that's really important, because it feels like it's really easy today that you educate yourself to this degree. And then you just, so I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to work with that on this company that specializes in that. Mm. And I would say it's really nice to maybe explore and try and don't be afraid. Mm. And maybe, like, as you said, you're not a graphic designer, but hey, of course you can do graphic design without an education. You just, like, need to maybe try it out, and maybe you learn something, and maybe you're like, oh, this is not my thing, and... I think also, don't be afraid in that sense.
No,
as a beginning, and then
I agree. And for students, I would say definitely learn tools and learn many tools to design, so that the tool doesn't become what limits your kind of potential. Because I remember that as a common thing where people didn't learn certain tools, and then you only create certain objects or ideas or spaces because of you not being able to do them, basically. And I think having time to be a student, you should really learn the craft of how to design, so that you then can come up with good ideas.
Yeah. And then take that skills and make... If it's physical, I mean, make it physical. I mean, graphic design is also physical. You can just print it. I mean, and then you get the feel of it, because I think that's really interesting and educational. And I, from our perspective, now when we've been a company for a while, we time to time get applications, like for internship or a job and so on. And it's always interesting to see the ones that have done their prototypes. It's not just a sketch or a rendering. It's like, it's also a physical model. Even if it's from cardboard, it's like, okay, they have done this and learned something.
Or
and
mock-up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's it's really important to learn the tools so they don't become a limitation, but it's also really important to don't be afraid to just make it in the physical space so you can interact with it.
And I think still, even though we, you know, there's all of these digital tools, one of the absolute best tools is a pen and a paper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And like having that tool, there's no faster way of communicating an idea.
Mm.
And I don't see how that will change. Even though it becomes a digital pen, it won't change. So I think having the speed to be able to do, you know, the survival of the fittest idea or whatever it would be, to be able to do many ideas and to be able to iterate, I think having that tool is of the greatest importance.
Yeah. And explore. I mean, try out the internship at agency that does this, like graphic design, and you learn, like you have 6 months and learn so much about graphic design and can get the experience in real projects and so on. And then maybe you go to more product design and I mean
learn the trade.
I think that's also good. It's like it feels like you educate yourself and then you should just be ready to work, and I think it's really good to learn to practice design in like in the workspace.
Oh yeah.
And don't decide that you're fully learned. You will never be fully learned.
Oh yeah, I know.
There's a saying that you're when you're around 80, then that's when you're the best designer. That's a good good thing to know.
What I see at the university is most people refrain from maybe teaching the tools. I'm talking about the teachers now. They try not to talk about the tools. You know, they don't talk about Figma, Photoshop, wherever. They don't teach exactly how to implement, but they always talk about the principles and the theories and whatnot. But I think what really pays off is to actually learn the tools. And then once you learn one of the tools, it's very easy to transfer that skill to, like, from Figma to Photoshop, from Photoshop to Illustrator, from that to like whatever people will invent 5 years later.
It's like a language.
Yeah. But if you never do that, you can learn all the theory that you want and you will never produce a design without actually using the tools. So whatever tools exist in that moment in time, it's very worthwhile to learn those things.
Yeah. You become a really good asset also when you come to a company if you know the tools.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You can help from day one, like from day one.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But speaking of times and being current, so what are you excited about these days? Like, what's next for OP at this point in time?
We have challenges both for the company and in the for us privately. Mm-hmm. We're actually
We're all four founders also becoming fathers.
Oh wow! All at the same time,
basically during this autumn. So
it's gonna be congratulations.
So that's a new challenge.
Is it the first time for all of you?
Wow!
We're growing. Like the OP family is now 9, and hopefully we're getting a bit bigger during the year and onwards, and then also of course the Stockholm thing with opening up an office. We need to find one first, but that's always a fun thing,
and
see what that could mean for us and how we could maybe expand a bit there and so on. So
we have a fun partnership with a company called Skewed also, which we work with, and it's a kind of a creative collective,
say.
And we do a lot of projects together with them as well.
And with them, we're starting up an office in London as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's really cool.
So they are mainly the driving force for that, of course. But we're part of the collective. And so that's also interesting to see what we can do with being more present in, abroad. That's going international is also a dream, of course.
Is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't covered so far? Is there maybe a question that you wish I have asked, or a piece of advice or request to our audience?
Don't do crap.
Don't design ugliness. No. No, I mean, don't be afraid to fail, I would say.
Don't fail forward.
I mean, exactly. Just try it out.
Fail and learn.
Yeah.
Do it again.
I would say a question would be how, or an interesting topic would be, how do we work creatively in this digital era? Mm. I mean, it's always, I mean, we have had Skype and so on for many years, but now because of the pandemic, it really like took off.
Mm.
And I think there are a lot of companies just thinking about how they could create products and so on that could help us that are working within the creative field. But I mean, now there are a lot of students within your community, but that could also be interesting to see their point of view of how are they thinking about the future of working and what are their expectations within within the field and the workplace. Mm. And when it goes much faster now to a digital era, I mean, I think that would be interesting to see if there are any good ideas and reflections on that one, because I think we're in this exploration phase for the whole industry, I would say.
That's really interesting. I do hope that people will leave some comments on YouTube, on Twitter, on Reddit, where I post these episodes also. Mm. Maybe we'll get some ideas from them. My kind of limited observation, because I'm not like in my 20s anymore, so I only observe now, looking at my cousins or, you know, there's my students and people, I'm observing that, you know, video is really becoming a thing. We have like TikTok, which is like a super sort of rising platform these days. The way that people consume and also produce video has really changed. It's reached the masses, you know.
Yeah.
I guess 10 or 20 years ago, if you wanted to make a video for whatever reason, you really sort of had to like fire up your computer, import from your camera, do your editing things. Today it's like your phone, blah, 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 10 seconds, your video is done.
Yeah.
But speaking of the internet, where can we find you on the internet if our audience wants to reach out to you for...
You can reach us on our website, oplineweb.se.
But you also have officeofpossibilities.se, right?
But that's not the easiest way to... and then we have op_update@Instagram.
Hmm.
So
those are our two main channels right now.
Cool.
And my number is not...
I'll put up the links in the descriptions in the article on our website, and I'll put your number up there as well. I have it. Cool. This was so much fun, guys. Thank you so much for sitting with us. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
Hope that I will see you again numerous times.
Yeah.
On camera and off camera as well. Thanks a lot.
More than welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 11 of Design Discipline, a conversation with the multidisciplinary design studio Office of Possibilities, or OP in short. If you found value in this conversation, you will probably enjoy past and future episodes of Design Discipline as well, where we explore and explain the vast landscape of design through concepts and conversations. So go ahead and download and subscribe to our podcast. Like and subscribe on our YouTube channel. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram as @DesignDiscipline, and join the membership program on our website, designdiscipline.com.